Good morning. How's your campus days going? Tough crowd, right? It's the second session on a Friday. It's probably the worst session that there is. You guys have been at the party last night for the Oktoberfest. Is that about right? Yeah, kind of hungover now. Yeah, you got to this first session. You're quite proud of yourselves. You had the coffees. Now they're all worn off and everything's sort of in the comfy chair and everything's just a little bit more. There'll be some people who probably drove a long way to get here from Yulan, from Foon. I saw the tractors parked out front. They're, yeah, a few people not laughing. yeah, so it's a tricky crowd. It's a talk about Windows 8.1. So really it's about what's better than Windows 8 in 8.1. Talking to you guys is I was kind of expecting almost a hostile audience because it was Windows 8 was received kind of mixed amongst the IT pro community, could we say? I was kind of expecting a room that would look a little bit more like that. But I'm quite glad to see that that's not the case. That's fine. We've got a couple of them over here to put tape on one of them as well, just to so there was no violent reaction against what they're doing back there. But luckily, all these guys that I was expecting here look like they're all a bit busy someplace else, annoying somebody else by being dicks somewhere else. So my name's Craig. I'm a Premier Field Engineer. I was talking on Tuesday here as well about SANS. Was anyone here for that one? Okay, so I that's less than a quarter. I can definitely use the same jokes again. I'm a Premier Field Engineer, which is a role that we have within Microsoft. I've been working at Microsoft for 5.5 years, where we help people who've paid for Premier support. And I usually ask people how many people have heard of Premier support from Microsoft. There's a couple, yeah, a few, yeah, yeah. Generally not so many. Which is a bit odd. It is it's a way of getting support from Microsoft at the highest possible levels. We have different groups of people who will come out and help you. For those who are not familiar with it, you sort of buy a contract 3 years in advance and pay for it up front and figure out how we're best going to optimize your environment for the next coming 12-month cycles as we go through. And we'll do that with things like having reactive support. So if you want to escalate a case that's incredibly mission critical for you to the highest levels, we can go ahead and do that. We can go in and do health checks on your environment and try and find problems before they become that big critset, critical situation, severity A problems. And we'll take all that knowledge that we learn from trying to fix your stuff and bundle it up and put it into that health check tool that I'll go and run, or we'll teach classes, workshops that I'll teach as well. We have 17 colleagues in my team that do the same job, where we do that proactive stuff. We try and prevent problems and make you get the help you get the most out of what you've invested in for Microsoft. So if anyone wants to talk about what more is Premier, come up and talk to me at the end of the session here as well. hostile crowd, difficult sell. Why should an IT pro really go and invest in putting some time and effort into 8.1 over Windows 8? First reason, probably the most easy to go and sell, is that it's absolutely free, 8.1. That's a fantastic reason, isn't it? So long as you've already got Windows 8, it's free for that one. If you've got Windows 7, you have to pull your trousers up a bit more. Support ends at the same time as Windows 8. That means that the clock has already started running. All right, so Windows 8 was released, and then you get effectively 10 years after that date. Windows 8.1 comes out, we don't go and add 10 years from that point. We started the clock back then. All right, so your 8.1 has already started, effectively. Right, and now we have 9 years of support, 4 years of standard support left. Standard support being the one where if you want to, say, request a design change within Windows, you think that we made a design decision and we don't like it, we want it to change something else, you invoke Premier support and we can actually go ahead and do that for you. We've now only got 4 years to do that, right? So the clock has started. And the other one is that it's out now and you can go and get it, go get your ISO file and then do your installations now, right? Volume licensing customers, that's what VL means at the start there, can just start installing it today. Well, 2 weeks ago. So here's our agenda, what we're going to try and cover in the hour and 15 that we've got. I've got a little timer that I forgot to kick off here, so I don't lose track. I always go way over on time. So I'm going to try and make sure that I behave myself today. So yeah, some of these topics will be quite short. I think the Windows to go one, the remote desktop services are kind of short, and we'll spend more time in the fun stuff. And if you're well behaved, at the end, I might do something that I think is a bit cheeky, and I might even ask the guys to stop recording it too, because it's kind of fun, I think. All right, so the start menu, probably the most controversial thing we've ever done. Windows 95 came out 18 years ago, and it had the little thing down the bottom that you clicked on, and it's been there ever since. We took it away from you, and everyone freaked out. It didn't stop you from doing anything. You could still push the start button. You could still drag your mouse down to the corner and click, and everything would still work. It was all the same, but it's difficult to break 18 years of habit. In fact, it wasn't even really a habit, was it? If you look into the statistics of where people go and launch applications from, the whole entirety of the start menu, most of it was never used. The bit that was most used was the stuff that appeared in the first list, right? Which is why we made it adaptive to what you were currently using. But predominantly, it was the icons along the bottom there, or what was on the desktop. They were 95% of where programs were launched from. That little search bar along the bottom, almost nobody used that one. There was all kinds of things that were in there that were never used, but as soon as you take it away, because you're not using it, people freaked out anyway. So what do we do in 8.1? We put it back. Hurrah, you've got a start button. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't do anything. It's the same exact icon that was there before, just slightly bigger, right? You could go down the last 4 pixels in the corner. We just made it a little bigger. Hurrah. You happy now, right? Put it back, and that was the other big complaint. We don't want to go into the tile screen when we first boot, log on, when we close our Metro applications. We want to go to the desktop. You can do that now too. So the two big things that IT pros gave us is a really clear message in thousands of blog posts, in hate mail to the blog announcing Windows 8, the B8 blog. We listened to you. We changed it. You should all be happy now. So thank you very much and goodbye. No, I'm not going to get away with that. Denmark wants value out of their investment in Windows, so I have to talk a little bit more about stuff here. Okay, so we're not just going to be able to go into the desktop. We're going to do things like make it so that when you go to the apps menu, so the tile, we can maybe change that so it's not the big tiles. Maybe it's the full list of apps. And it's not just the full list of apps. We take all the ones that would be Windows Store apps, Metro apps, whatever you want to call them. We stick them at the end so that you just see the 32-bit, 64-bit applications, the full applications that you used to. Put them first, so you see them first. And then it will look a lot like the start menu, just a lot bigger, so you can use more of your screen to see the icon that you're looking for, rather than waiting for an expansion of a start menu. You remember that expanding start menu? You'd click on it, get like 8 items, and you'd say, expand it out, and it would go this big, and then there'd be maybe a page down, and you can't really find stuff. Now we can just see all of it on our screen at the same time. So we can do that now, and I'll show you that in a second. we can control the way that it's laid out, both by a GUI and through group policies as well. So you can push out settings that you want onto people. Assigned access, we'll get onto, is quite interesting. It's more for kiosks. If you take a tablet and have a look at it, it's a really interesting piece of equipment. It changes the way people think about doing stuff. Delta Airlines just bought 11,000 surfaces, and they're going to use them on their airplanes, but generally they just want one app running all the time. They don't need all of that stuff. They don't want the start button to work at all. You know, they just want to be able to use it as a handheld device to do stuff. So we can go and assign that one user the ability just to use one application. Windows key X, right? The shortcut key is going to become your new best friend. And I'll show you what it can do and how you can add stuff to it as well. Well, kind of. And then search, we made really different as well by integrating it with Bing. Again, you can control that with group policy, switch that whole thing off and control it so that if I'm maybe on a different type of network, I don't use that. So, jump to it. Let's play around with some stuff here. So, I'll jump out and go down to my desktop here, and I'll show you the options I'm talking about. So, what I did there is I just right-clicked somewhere in the blank space, properties, go to navigation, and let's see here. We'll start with this one here because he's quite friendly. Show my desktop on background start. So I've got a little nice picture of Lucas there pushing his face through a badminton racket. I hit the start button and he stays there. So it's less jarring to go into the tile menu. Before it was just the blue background was the default color. Let me switch it off there. And it's a little bit more like jumping to another world, isn't it? Right? So I can go and customize that one. Group policy controlled. Let's see. This is the when I sign in, take me to the desktop option. And it means that if I'm running an application, let's see if I can try and launch one here, maybe stocks. No, my screen resolution's too low. I can't run any of my applications because they're, yeah, exactly. Look at him. He's
Sorry.
Yeah. What can you do? All right. Ooh, that's going to make my next demo kind of tricky, isn't it? Okay, that's going to be fun. Okay. What was the other one? This one here. Okay, so when I go to my start menu, please show me the list of apps, right? So before I have this list here, right, the tiles that I can scroll my way around in, I want to go and show me the apps view. So I click onto there and I get the apps view. Where did the apps view come from? How do I get to that? What's all that one about? Let's go back a bit. I've got this list here. A little arrow appears. If I use a mouse, an arrow just appears. And I can get to the screen below, which is my list of apps, right? But you see here that I've got all the Windows Store apps first, and all the applications that I've installed that you're probably more used to seeing, like my admin tools, and what else have I got installed here? The Office icons, all those proper heavy 32-bit applications that aren't tiles yet. Come on, Sonos, we want a tile app. They're not there, right? So I can say, show me the apps view first, and when I show me the apps view, make sure that they're sorted by category. And what that means is everything that has a category goes at the end. Everything that doesn't have a category, which is all of my 32-bit applications, get listed first. There they are, my 32-bit applications. Yeah? Cool. Controlled by group policy. So everyone's happy now. No, because we still got this. What is this? Why is everyone so angry about this whole system here? This is really cool, right? This thing here is really cool. I was skeptical when I first saw it as well, too, right? But what it is these are little bubbles of applications that you can go and write in a whole bunch of different languages that will run on an ARM-based machine, like an iPad, right? That's an ARM-based machine. It can run on an ARM-based machine, so my Surface runs on that. It'll run on a 32-bit machine, a 64-bit machine. For us to get applications that can run on 64-bit and 32-bit, we have to go and install two OSs effectively. Right, we compile Windows in 64-bit and 32-bit and stick it onto your machine, and now you've got really two versions of Windows at the same time. So to be able to run on two different types of OSs is actually quite hard. This tile system will run on an ARM machine, 32-bit, 64-bit, a server, a desktop, and coming soon, an Xbox One. Right? Isn't that amazing? The same, and holy cow, it'll even run on here. The same OS, really. This is Windows 8 OS. Right, it's the same thing as an ARM machine and that machine. If you can get an app that runs on all, it's not the exact same app, right? An app that runs on here isn't exactly the same as the one that can run on the Windows Store. That's why they've got two separate stores. But you make very slight changes to say things like, don't go and look for a gyroscope because it may not be that you have a gyroscope, or make sure that your screen resolution doesn't exceed these sort of parameters, and allow advertisements to be top and bottom, these sorts of things. Once you've done that, then you can just go and port your application from one place to the other. So these little bubbles here are really, really important. And you'll start to see a lot more line of business applications appearing in this screen here. Don't be afraid of it. This is really something cool that is not going to go away. The flexibility that it gives us is massive. It's not just for touch first. There's a lot of applications in here that I use every day to do things like we have mandatory training we have to do every quarter. I'll use the application that comes in here to do that. Right? videos that we record, if I wanted to get a message out to a whole bunch of people, I'd record a video, stick it onto to a service. I'll use one of these tile applications. We use them internally a lot. The cool thing is that I don't need to have a domain join machine to do any of that stuff. I can just use my RT device that can't join a domain and go and use that application within there. I just give it credentials. Right? And off I go. Where else did we get to here? Enforcing a start screen layout. So I have this layout of tiles here. Maybe I'll show you something else that we can do. I'll go down to settings and say this row of three tiles is actually a little bit small. That's because the damn resolution is too small. If I had a little bit higher in my screen, I could flick this onto yes, as it has been, and I should be able to get four. So I can't quite do it here again. Anyway, okay, so I've got this layout. I like it a lot. And I want to go and export this whole layout as an XML file, stick it up on a file share, apply a group policy to everyone who will read that file, and then have the exact same layout. Right, so you don't have to worry about what people have got on their machines. They all look the same. It's a nice way of enforcing a standardized desktop onto people. So let's go and do that one. So I have PowerShell up here. Let's go and get a list of all the export the current layout that I have here. Export app. Start. And export my start layout to path. We're loving ISE. I don't do PowerShell, right? I'm terrified of this thing. When this blue screen came up here, like I'm sweating now because of looking at this. I don't know what I'm doing here, but and I can do it, right? So that's how simple this stuff is. Set the path. Export this to an XML file. Where should the XML file be? I'll put it into a folder called layouts and then say demo layout.xml. Now, if I just do that command, it'll go ahead and work. But what it gave me is not so useful, actually, because if I open this guy up in Text Reader, it's binary, and I can't see what's in there, and I can't really do anything with it. What I can do with that file is I can take my Windows image that I'm about to deploy to hundreds of machines, and I can inject it into the deployment package so that that's what they will look like. That's all I can use that for. I can't run an import start layout command. I can only run that import command on an offline image, not on this particular machine. So this one's kind of not really what I want. So what I want to do is change the file format here. So let me just kill that file off. And I'll say that, look, when you do that export, can you do it as an XML file, not a binary file? Off it goes. And let's see if we get something a little bit better now. And maybe we can go and wrap that. Where's my wrap? There. And what you can see is things like link should be this size, 150 by 150. And if I don't want it to be 150 by, if I go and change my mind, the boss says, actually, we want it to be a full size one. Maybe 310 by 310, or a wide, tall one, right? These guys here, 310 by 150. You can go and just edit it, right? These are the applications. Now, if I don't have some of these applications installed, if I don't have Yammer installed yet, when I go and apply this file, it will just leave a hole where Yammer was sitting. Where was Yammer? There. It will just leave a hole there. And as soon as I do install it, it'll pop the icon into it. So it'll just leave holes where they shouldn't be. So now I've got a usable file now. That's great. So the way I'll go and import that one is to run gpedit. And let's see. I apply it to the user. I go to the start menu, and I go to start screen layout. And I give it the name of the file that it should use. Now, it could be /// file server. And you put in a UNC path so that everyone can get it. You could make that the name of the domain /netlogon if you're using that, and it will replicate around. Or in this case, I don't have that, right? I'm just a standalone machine. I'm not going to really go down that whole road. So layouts, demo layout.xml. Now, before I go and hit OK on this one, what I'll do is I'll make a quick change to my start screen. Let's say get rid of that one there, unpin it from the start screen, right? Because I can make those changes. You see, if I hit right click, I get this customized thing, which allows me to go and group things, create names, whatever else it is that I want to do. As soon as I go and apply this group policy, I can't remember if I need to update. I'll do it anyway. Cool. Let's see what we get now. Can't right click anymore. And the icon didn't come back. Why didn't it come back? I think I have to log in and log out, don't I? I don't want to do that because it'll kill off my PowerPoint and stuff. Yeah, I think you're right there, buddy. That's a shame. Damn. I only ever tested the right click. Okay. But there you go. Group policy, right? You can apply it to all your machines. And Windows key X was this list here. And you get the same one just by right-clicking that famous start button there. Disk manager, all the tools that you'll ever need. And this one here, command prompt. Not a lot of people will like that anymore. There's some PowerShell people who do like it. I like it a lot, but PowerShell people don't. But we can go and change that one. Replace command prompt with PowerShell when I hit Windows key X. There we go. Neat, huh? Was there anything else I was missing there? Assigned access. Okay, cool. So I've got a kiosk user, and I want to give him some access. Let's see, where's my kiosk user? Jump down here, PC settings, and where are my accounts? So I've got a bunch of other accounts in here, and I can go and edit that account. He's a standard user, blah, blah, blah. Okay, and I can go and set up assigned access for this one. So I have to have logged on once before as kiosk, because when I log on as a user, I install all of those initial core applications like mail, calendar, people, those sorts of things. They all get installed when I log on, which is why your first log on with Windows 8 and still 8.1 takes a bit longer, because we have to install those applications. You can't remove them. Right, first log on will take about a minute, minute and a half. So I've logged on already as kiosk. So he's already got some applications. These are the ones that it installed for me. So if I say have him open up any one of these, they're not going to run because of the thingy. I'll choose maps anyway. And so that's Kiosk's requirement. He must only now run maps. So if I go and do a switch user and log on as Kiosk, .\Kiosk, and say, what was his password? Yes. It should launch the map application. Doesn't, because it can't bloody run because of the resolution. Had it run, it would show me the maps application, and I can't leave it. I can't get to the swipe in charms. I can't get a list of other running applications. I can't bring up the list from the bottom. I can't escape. I can't close it by swiping down. I can't do anything. So how the hell do you fix that machine once you have successfully logged on as Kiosk if your resolution was right? How do you do anything? How do you get on as somebody else to fix this? If it is a tablet, then the requirement for tablet is that it has a Windows button. You push that button 5 times, and then you'll be able to log on as somebody else. You'll get this prompt here to log on again. But that was the GUI, right? And it's the new GUI, so it's not terribly fun. What to do now? There we go. So we can go and control that through, through PowerShell commands as well. So what I've got here is my get out of jail free card. If any of my demos didn't work, I should have taken screenshots of everything. So there's the layout that you can go and edit and dump it down as a group policy. There's our Kiosk guy, and we can go and get the assigned access. So find out who has been assigned access and to what, and we get it listed by these application names. And I can go and set an assigned application to Kiosk by some name, Bing Maps, Helps and Tips. This requires log off and log on of that Kiosk user. And you specify the app name. How do I get the app name? That was this one here. Get AppX package. So list all of my installed applications for me, right? I'm running this PowerShell as me. And I get these lists of names that are applications that are installed. And I go and quote those. Yep. Cool. All that's 8.1. Couldn't do that before. Search is quite cool now. So if I want to jump into my start menu and I start typing something like internals. Are you kidding me? Okay, good job I got the screenshots then, huh? Let's see. Yeah, so on the left side, on the left side, you've got a list of all the files that are on my machine, right? Things that I can index are in within my my profile, maybe my index locations that I'm allowed to go and see, right? Not other people who are logged into this or the terminal server or whatever else it is. So they're my files that have that word in it. The next one is a site that I've visited recently. So that's Bing results customized for me, right? Bing has realized that I went from a Bing Live Microsoft page where I was signed in, I went to that page there, and it remembered that one for me, and it gives me that one first, because that's the one I typically go to, so I can run my sysinternals tools live. And then the next one is Bing search results, right, where I've gone through and gotten search results. Yeah. Yeah, so this search bubble isn't able to talk to other applications. Right? Yeah. And the other applications aren't able to talk, like Outlook, its index can't go into the same index that we're looking at here. Yes. I didn't make any of these decisions, man. I'm just here to tell you how it works, right? And you got to work around it. That's why we get paid so much, isn't it? We all get paid a phenomenal amount of money to figure out how to work around these sorts of things. And you can go and customize the search so that you can say things like, don't use Bing, just use the local search when you start typing stuff in there. Or you could say, use Bing so long as you don't pay for your bandwidth. If I've got a 3G card in the machine, I've got one in here, I can set it so that that one becomes, well, by default, it is a metered connection, which means you pay for megabytes or time connected, whatever one it is. And it says, well, you're currently on one of these metered connections, so don't go and use the Bing part. But when you're back on the wireless or through the wire, then you should use Bing. And yes, you can only use Bing. Is the next question that, yeah, exactly. Why would we do that, right? Why would we give somebody else a door in there? Connectivity. Okay, so I mentioned the 3G thing, so I think that's kind of where we're going here. Yeah, so 3G works natively. So if I've got a 3G radio in my machine, right, with a SIM card in there, as I do, I don't have to install drivers. We have something called a class driver system. So you'll see the drivers that install for your particular device will have the word class.sys somewhere in there. They should, so long as they meet the 8.1 hardware requirements, so the BIOS of that device, the firmware of it, it will just work. Right, you don't have to go and install other stuff, this weird pop-up package that will come up from your charms menu on the side there. And it will tether as well, which means that you can go and share that 3G connection with other people who connect to you as a wireless hotspot. So you set yourself up as a wireless hotspot, and other people can now browse out through your connection, up to 15 connections at one time. And I would really love to be able to demo that one to you too, but that hardware requirement changed at the last minute, and my particular radio, the BIOS on it, doesn't work. So Windows can't turn it on, so I'm waiting for HP to go and get that upgrade. It's a really popular HP model, the one that I have, so I don't think it's going to take too long. I saw the emails flying around with the HP people who panicked about it, so it's going to be quite quick. But you might see that as well yourselves when you start deploying it, right? I try and turn on the radio, it just doesn't work. Just so you know, I'm a support person, right? I'm not a salesperson, so I want to get it working for you guys the best way. Third-party VPNs now work. Oh, was that a question? Sorry? No? Third-party VPNs, I'll show you some screenshots of that one, and we can auto-start VPNs. Workplace join, now this is, we're already got 53 minutes to go, so I'm not going to be able to go too deep into workplace join and what web application proxy does. This is a monster new thing that we've gone and come up with. Huge. Along with work folders as well. Work folders is really quite significant. So I'm not going to be able to go too deep into what they are. But if you want to come up afterwards maybe and ask questions about how they really work under the hood and what sort of bits and pieces I need working, I can talk about that too. Which invokes a whole thing about being able to selectively wipe data off a lost machine. So here's our connection. We get into this from the networks part of PC settings, right? And you can just toggle that one on and off to enable sharing. And as soon as I turn it on, I get a little pop-up underneath there that shows me the wireless hotspot name that Windows has chosen and the password that people should type in to connect to you. We've got it grayed out on this machine here because it's my machine, because it's domain joined. And if it's domain joined, our group policies come in and say, you can't connect to Starbucks and the Microsoft network at the same time. That's not going to work. My group policies say any internet connection sharing must be disabled on this machine. And it's probably likely that you might have this at your networks as well, just so that you know when you go into this that you don't go, oh, Craig promised us the world and it's not going to happen. And that's the mobile device unit in there that doesn't currently work, but will very shortly. Third-party VPN. We support these VPN in-box. In-box. I'll show you what the GUI looks like, and I'll show you how it really works. So you go into your network, and you say, I want to go and create a new VPN connection. And this is the wee pop-up that you get there. And you get this little thing here, if I can zoom in a bit. Shows you a list of the different vendors that you can choose from. And as you connect to your VPN server, it will come back and say, you know what, we don't require a password here. We require a password and an RSA token, or a password and an SMS code. So this set of properties will adjust themselves based on the information that we connect with to come back. Big problem with that list is that it doesn't include Cisco. I don't know what's happening there. But I'll show you what is happening under the hood, and you can kind of figure it out yourself. If I go to C, Windows, and then VPN plugins, I see them all here, and they're just AppX things. They are these. That's all it is. And look how much code they had to go and write to do it. So it's not going to be too long until everyone gets on board here, because we can just go and install these from the Windows Store. Right? It's just that in box, we have these four. That's pretty cool. So you can figure out for yourselves how long it's going to take for everyone to get on board who you are interested in for your VPN endpoints. A Windows Store app, like these guys here, can launch a VPN. Can't complete the launch because they need credentials from you, right? We don't want a VPN to completely just create the tunnel without you ever typing a password or a PIN number or something important. So they can launch the VPN for you, so long as your machine is not domain joined. If it is domain joined, we can't have this feature working at all. For IT pros, what are you talking about, Craig? Why would I be concentrating about machines that aren't domain joined? From this point on, pretty much everything that I'm going to talk about is about non-domain joined machines, because that's the way that we see you guys going. You're going to be investing more and more in non-domain joined machines. What would you call a non-domain joined machine? What's the catchphrase that people have been using the last couple of days? Bring your own devices. Yeah. That's where we've been investing, and bring your own devices. If I have a domain joined machine, what should I really be using? Direct access. Don't need a VPN then. I just turn on my machine and I'm on CorpNet. That's what really you should be going for. So this is how you go and configure it. You say, for this particular application, so in this case we're using Remote Desktop, Terminal Services Client, when this one launches, as it launches, fire up this particular VPN connection name, the friendly string that you've named it as. And away you go. And to show you it in action, I've got a little video of someone doing it. So he goes and launches this timeline application. As soon as it launches, requires logon, so he gets this wee pop-up, which will automatically fire up his particular VPN. And he has to type in his credentials into there to get that working. Right, so his particular VPN requires, this is a virtual smart card, and we'll get onto that in a second. And off he goes and connects, right? So the application says launch the VPN. You have to do all the work after that, though. We workplace join. Okay. Yeah, this is a monster. This is really, really huge and really important as well, this stuff. It's going to be, you're going to see this a lot, I think. This is probably going to be the one thing that you'll do in the next 12 months at your workplace, right? It doesn't require a whole lot of changes on your network is the thing to get this going. But the ramifications are big. So this is how it kind of works. We need to take our devices, like our RTs, whatever else they are, our iPads, our Android phones, our whatever else they are, and a user starts using them, right? And they're not, like I log on to my thingy here, but I don't use my credentials, my domain credentials, you know, I use my live account or something. So I'm kind of a non-person, but I'm a person using that device and I can give that device to my kids, right? And they'll log on as themselves with a picture password and they'll play their games. I don't want that device to be able to access anything on my network while my kids are logged into it. I want it to work only while I'm in there. So we need a way of tying me to that device, no matter what the operating system is, and have them access corporate resources, so long as it's just me doing it. That's what workplace join means. So we have a guy logging onto a thing, whatever the thing is, and we have our AD, over there, yes. This device goes and talks to web application proxy. And the way that it does that is by, if it's a Windows 8 machine, 8.1, 8's kind of not there anymore. We don't expect 8 to be around for very long. In fact, you've kind of got a couple of years to do your upgrades and then it's unsupported. And that way you can kind of think of 8.1 as a service pack, right? There hasn't been a service pack for Windows 8. I would say it's unlikely that there will be. There hasn't been a service pack 2 for Windows 7. I would say it's unlikely as well. Service Pack 1's been sitting there for a really long time. There's a big enterprise hotfix roll-up. The only KB article that I remember, 2775511, put it on all of your Windows 7 machines, because you're pretty much not going to get another Service Pack, I think. I don't know. I'm down here on the org chart, remember? I'm at the bottom, in the mud, in the dirt, upside down. No idea what's going on. But looking at things, if they say that Windows 8 is expiring in 2 years because you've got 8.1, then you've got to think of it in that way. And the hotfix roll-ups as well. I don't know if you guys, have you guys got Windows 8 on your machines, like use in every day? Wow. Okay. You used to have this idea of private hotfixes, right? In Windows 7 and everything previous, where you'd find a bug, we'd fix it, but we wouldn't release it for everyone. You'd have to go and sign up and maybe type your email address, maybe a code, and it might even say, we're not even going to release it to you anyway. You have to go through Microsoft support, and they will evaluate whether you should have this fix. But we know it's a problem, and we fixed it. We all went, ooh, no good, bugger. Let's go and write some code, and they did, and they fixed it. But you can't get it, because it's not well tested. Now we take all of our hot fixes, bundle them all up together, and push them all out every month. Every month in your Windows update list, you'll see hotfix rollup for Windows 8, March. That's all of our hotfixes. And if we're giving you all of our hotfixes every month, what's the point in bundling them all up and putting them into a service pack? You've got access to them already. They're already there. So that kind of logic says to me that don't sit around waiting for another service pack to come out. Don't know how we got onto that one. Okay, so user on some device goes to web application proxy. And it'll be a control panel applet on a Windows 8.1 device. Right, control panel applet for workplace join. For all of the others, you give them a web page that they go to. They go to the web page, and effectively the control panel applet is just a little web client, really, doing the hard work for you. Go to the web application proxy. He asks you to authenticate. Normal username and password. That talks back to ADFS, Federation Services, which does a thing. It requests on your behalf a certificate. It stores the certificate in AD in a user, in an object that it's created for you. You who is logged into that machine. If I go and log into another machine, I get a different object in AD. If somebody else logs into my machine, they get a different object in AD. All right, so it's not a user account, it's not a computer account, it's the combination of both of them. This user on that machine, or that user on this machine, they all get different objects in AD. So I create an object in AD, stick a certificate into it, and then send a copy of that certificate over to that relationship of me having logged into here. So this is like H key current user, right? I'm going to get that certificate, but it relates only on this machine here. With that certificate, I can then go off and talk to things like Windows Intune and say, I'm a trusted person. ADFS has gone and authenticated me. It's set up a certificate. And if you don't believe me, you can go back and talk to SCCM, who will talk to AD for you and verify that I am who I say I am. SCCM is talking to whatever SCCM talks to and pushes out config changes to Windows Intune and says, if anyone joins up to you, this is the kind of policies that we want to have on them. They must have encrypted files. They must have a PIN number. Next time they contact you, please wipe them because apparently the device has been stolen. All that sort of thing happens. There's the objects in AD. So this is the root of the domain. Registered devices appears at the root of your domain. You just need one 2012R2DC somewhere in your network, which means your schema has to upgrade. And then it will create this in your domain, registered devices. And then you'll get this GUID list appearing, one for each user on a device. Right? And the type of object is called MSDS device. It's still a 300-level course, right? So I could do the little fluffy sales bit at the start and still do internals of objects as well, right? We're allowed to do that. It's 300-level. Set your expectations right. When you get to the survey, you know what to answer. Good, good. We're all on the same page. So I've gone and issued this certificate to my device. So when I look at my device, when I go to the certificate store, I can see this certificate. It's being issued by a guy called MS Organization Access, which is ADFS. He did the issuing for me. I store a copy of it. And it is issued not to me, the person, not to that device, but to us as a pair who is identified by our GUID, same exact GUID. So the object name and the certificate name are the exact same thing. And that GUID, so this one that starts with 4708CA52, relates to that, oh my God, I can't even point to it, that's device ID, this one here. 4708CA52. So GUIDs, when we write them in that format, we swap these octets around just to confuse and annoy people. You can see that the registered owner is someone with a SID, my SID, right? This is Craig's device. That's I own it. This is a list of people who are allowed to be on this device. So other people who have gone through that process, maybe I have a colleague in my office who used my RT device. So they are also a registered owner on here. They will have their own object, but it avoids that confusion of figuring out who's the primary owner and who are other people who are able to own it. And then I dump a copy of the certificate up in here. This attribute I've highlighted is really, really long. That is the certificate. And with that certificate, you can do all kinds of things, right? So it's the ability to give permissions to this device pairing. Even though it's not domain joined, I can give it some access. Maybe I can go back to web application proxy and go to some SharePoint sites. Not all of them, but maybe some of them. So I can have that tiered layer of permissioning. Domain joined machines that are fully managed, you get everything. Non-domain joined machines, you get some things. Guy appearing with just a user account gets even less. Right? So you can have this tiering of trust. Work folders. We've got this installed on our network kind of as a trial proof of concept. As soon as it's available, I jump onto anything that that moves because it's so much fun. It doesn't often work all the time and needs constant upgrades and blah, 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 but I love it. And so I've signed up to our work folders set up here. And what we do to install work folders is really, really, really painfully easy, but the magic that's going on behind it is really quite impressive. So what we do is we set up a file server, normal standard file server, right, with NTFS shares on it, all your permissions, all that sort of stuff is as normal. We go and install an additional part of the file server role that's called work folders. As you click on it, that wee box pops up that says IIS Hostable Web Core. What I'm doing is I'm running my file server also as a web server, but not a full-blown IIS web server, just enough to open up port 80 and 443 to have data come in, and I will go and figure out what I need to do to give that guy the file. All right, so it's just enough web server is what you want to think of that one as. So here's the user's experience of it. They open up control panel. Right, this is you could do all of this stuff that I'm about to show you through one group policy setting that says you have work folders. That's it, right? But this is the step through. So I click on the wee button that says set me up for work folders, please. What I do is I type in my UPN. It says type in your email address because this appears on a Windows 8.1 machine that is an RT device that they went out and bought from Fauna yesterday, just as it applies to your corporate machines. So we need this to work really, really easily. We don't know who's going to be typing in what here, so we say type your email address, and we assume that a user's email address is the same as their UPN that they log into when they come to work. So this might cause you guys a bit of a problem because your UPNs are not necessarily your email address. So you type in your email address, and it will go and try and resolve that contoso.com to figure out, because you're on corporate network, right? You've got to be on the corporate network for this bit to work, to try and figure out where it is that your home folder is. If it doesn't work, and until you've gone and set up your publishing points, it's not going to work, you can also, it'll come up with a fail message, would you like to type in the URL? You can type in the URL, this is of the web server, right? You can publish the web server through web application proxy. This is the internal name of the web server. We only use an internal name for our work folders. So I type in the URL, which gets me back to the server. I talk to the server and say, well, this is who I am. He goes off and says, well, these are the folders that you have, or holy cow, I haven't set up a folder for you, so I better set up a folder for you with all the default permissions and apply a quota, because that's what you did when you were installing the server role. Where would you like to keep your copy of work folders on your machine? I'd like to keep it in this particular folder here. This part you can define through group policy. That's the only thing you can define in group policy. And then as it's doing this, it's talking to the web server who's received the policy while you were setting up that says things like, you must encrypt every file that goes down onto that machine using EFS, meaning this device has to register for a certificate that is an EFS certificate. Your machine must require a password. If you bought this machine from Fauna, you don't have to type a password, do you? You know? But that's not very secure because then it means that unauthenticated sessions from remote can go and connect to your machine. So you must have a password, and your machine will pop up and ask you for a password. This whole system here is going to be backported to Windows 7 as well. So Windows 7 will also pop up and require that you type a password, but we're not going to go to any other OSs in that one, I don't think. And then, yes, you must automatically lock your screen. Makes sense, right? You can't just have a screen sitting there unlocked. No point having a password if the screen never locks. And the next time you synchronize, if I've been told you lost this device, I'm allowed to delete everything in that work folder. Everything that sits in that folder there, you agree that I'm allowed to delete it. All right? Erase all files. And then we've got this other thing about data policies that might include things like you aren't allowed to keep corporate data longer than 7 years because it might mean that we get in legal trouble. If we have evidence of us doing something dodgy 8 years ago, we don't want you to have it. We can apply a policy onto your Windows 8.1 machine that says anything older than X years automatically gets deleted. So I agree to all of these terms and conditions. You can turn them on and off as you want to from the file server side. And then we start synchronizing. This is the GUI that I see as the user, right? If I'm trying to troubleshoot things, I go to the control panel. It says this is the quota space that I've been given. Ours has just been upgraded to 25 gigs. Are you allowed to sync over a 3G connection or not? And if it's not working, I can just go and click the Sync Now button. And by default, it'll synchronize every 30 seconds. So this is offline files, but it's not offline files because it doesn't need domain join. You can do it on non-domain join as well. So I have my work folder set up on my domain joined and my RT device. And I can synchronize the same set of files across both of them. Same files. I can go and edit a Word document on my RT and I will see it on my machine within a minute. And that's what the user sees it as. So we go and create these folders for you as well. There was a little folder there that MSIT has got on pre-created called Profile, which we might get to as we continue on. What do we got here? Yeah, so this is the group policy settings. That's it. The URL for this particular user, we're talking to the user part of the group policy, and they got no choice. Should you just force it upon them? Or do you want them to be prompted and that this answer of where they should go to, that that's already filled in? Security. Oh, yeah. Cool. Okay. Gonna have to speed up a bit here, guys. Three things in security that I want to focus on. There's a ton of other things as well, but we just don't have time. We're on 35 minutes now. Native biometrics. Last year, so 2012, Facebook had 9.8 million user accounts accessed unauthorized. Unauthorized accesses of a user account in 1 year. If you take 6 million standard users, right, just people out in the world, and you pass all of their passwords through a list of the most 100,000 commonly used passwords, we will be able to break into 98.1% of all of those accounts. We all use the same dumb passwords. Who has two digits at the end of their passwords and the first character starts with a capital letter and you've probably got a theme around it? I heard someone say, I'm looking for a movie name that starts with T because I'm onto the T's now for my password, right? Not too difficult to go and figure out what his next password might be or take some guesses, right? It's gone and eliminated it. The system is failing. 2013, 63% of all small businesses were broken into, compared to a year before, that was only 41%. Compare that to big enterprises that you guys will probably be in. You're all getting broken into all the time. Are you still sure about your passwords? Your domain admin password. I know the domain admin password to an organization, and the domain admin password has the number 2001 in it, because that's when they set it, and they haven't changed it since then. And every consultant who has ever worked there knows what this password is. So we wanted to change things in Windows 8.1, and we went and added native biometrics. So if you have a fingerprint reader on your machine, you don't need to install the drivers and go through that cumbersome enrollment process that comes with your software vendor, whoever made that piece of equipment. And we had a bit of a bump along the way. It was that Apple went and bought the biggest fingerprint reader in the world. They sold about 90% of all the fingerprint readers and put them onto the iPhone. And it was hacked in 48 hours, I think. They paid $2 billion, and now it's circumventable by anyone who has a copy of your fingerprint just from leaving it on a thing like that. You can go and print it out on a nice thick printer and work around it. So we're kind of hoping that our hardware vendors don't have the same vulnerabilities as the one that just got hacked. But the idea here is that we can natively sign into our machine just using a fingerprint, and it's not just a fingerprint, it's a touch, not that swipe, 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 come on, please work now. Was it the next finger? I can't remember. Just touch, log on, right? So it does a broad scan of what the fingerprint looks like from there, from that one touch. We've included this as part of something within Exchange Active Sync that they call the convenience logon bit. So I can enforce policies on my devices that say you are or are not allowed to use convenience logon. And a convenience logon could be a picture password, or it could be a fingerprint. It could be a whole broad range of different things. So it's part of the policies within your Exchange server to say whether this works or not, whether you allow it or not, or whether you have to use it or not. You can use fingerprints from within these apps. So I go and launch some application, like BBC has just announced that it's going to have all of its content available for purchase, so that you can go and buy old episodes of Doctor Who or whatever else it is that you want to watch. If I want to buy stuff from within an app, I can authorize that with a fingerprint. Because what happens when I go to buy something? If I have to go and buy something and I type my password for my live account, which I keep quite secure, right? I want it to be nice and long and complicated. When I type that password, I screw it up the first time. I screw it up the second time, and then by then I've come to my senses and said, Doctor Who? What am I thinking? I don't want that. and I've stopped buying it. If I can speed up that buying process, things will become a lot better. So we've made that one a top priority, that you can prove, you can authenticate to your live account, your Microsoft account, sorry, using a fingerprint, so that these high value transactions, they don't slip by, so that app manufacturers get more buy-in, right? And yeah, it because it's your live ID, you can go and customize anything you want using your fingerprint, and it will follow you as well. Stops cloaking applications too, so that you don't get prompted to type your password to the wrong kind of application, because you're never typing a password. Virtual smart cards. We use these like crazy in MSIT. A smart card is in my bag. It looks like a credit card, has a little gold chip on it. Gold chip looks exactly the same as a SIM card. On that, we go and store certificates and the private key. So the public part of the certificate is visible. The private key, you have to type in a PIN number to get to it. You type the PIN number wrong too many times, that piece of plastic now goes in the rubbish bin. All right? You cannot hammer into it. The cryptography that encrypts that private key is stored on the smart card. So you can't figure out how they've gone and encrypted it, never mind what the value was. So they're fantastic pieces of equipment, but they're extremely expensive to go and implement and manage, right? So if a new person starts going to set up a new one, we can set up something that's called a virtual smart card, where we have basically the same properties of a normal smart card, which is that the private key is stored inside the device and can't ever be exported out from it. That the cryptography is isolated onto the device and you can't ever hammer it, as in you can't type 100,000 bad passwords and expect it to pop out. As soon as you type a set number of bad passwords, it will lock. These properties we can have inside TPM. So we created a service on your machines that can install a virtual smart card into your TPM. And if you wanted to use that cool stuff that is a smart card, you don't have to pay for anything that is a device. You just need to have run a service, typed one command, enrolled in a certificate, and you're done. And all of that whole workflow stuff is now included in FIM. So you can go and deploy virtual smart cards to your users really, really easily. So this is how we did it at MSIT. We use it for two-factor authentication, these virtual smart cards. So my virtual smart card on my machine here is good enough for me to VPN to work. Previously, I needed to have a real physical smart card. But that physical thing is just something that I have, right? Something I have and something I know is two-factor authentication. The bit that I had was my smart card. Now the bit that I have is my laptop. I have a laptop. Right? That is my that's my second factor of authentication. The first factor is that I know the PIN number that can release my smart card onto it. And we use that for remote access. We also start using it locally as well for applications that I need to connect to, highly secure ones, like getting access to code. You don't just want people to be able to type their password and get into that. You want something more than that. Prove who the client is, mutual authentication. Because it's a smart card, we built smart cards to be able to be redirected inside terminal services. So I go in terminal services over to that server over there. I bring my smart cards with me so I can use them to log into that one. So you can take all your servers and say, no one's allowed to log into them unless they have a smart card. But I can just bring it along from my local machine. This knows who I am. Use it to encrypt mail as well. My BitLocker key. If I wanted to take a removable disk, right, like a USB connected disk, I can go and encrypt that one and say the thing that unlocks it when I plug it in might be a PIN number, well, a password really. It might be the recovery key, which no one can remember, it's about that long, or it could be a smart card. The smart card could be the virtual one that I have on this machine. What it means is I plug in that disk to this machine, it can only open up on this machine. That removable disk only ever works on this piece of hardware. You need to have this smart card on here, and it's not exportable. So we have 10,000 people internally using services that are enrolled for virtual smart card services, and 81,000 machines that are normal, like my type machines, enrolled for smart cards. We did that in 6 months, voluntarily. There was no push. People came and did this themselves. So now I can VPN from my Surface RT. If I'm going to get a virtual smart card on my machine, well, how do we know that this machine is trustworthy enough? Well, I have to go and ask my manager, and she approves a little workflow thing that goes back to FIM and says that that's been approved, right? So it sends it out as an email, you click on a link, FIM receives the link, away you go. Or I come along with my physical smart card and say, I would like to request a certificate for this machine. But that requires that I have a smart card reader for this one. Now, we have a USB key here, but I personally didn't have a smart card reader that plugged into it, so I can put my one in there. But that's just us. That's how we've chosen to deploy virtual smart cards. How you want to do it is up to you. But you can just do it manually as well. You run a command. This one's kind of a big, juicy one. If I have a... Oh, attestation means I attest to doing something. I promise that I'm doing things the right way. You go into court and you attest that your name is Craig. Right? KPM key attestation means that we attest that our key has been stored the right way. If I request a certificate from a server and I say, I want to have the private key and I'll obey you when you say, don't export it. I can do whatever I want with that private key. Now, a Windows machine that's not been hacked will keep that private key and not let you export it and save it to another file and send it off to another machine. But one that's had its binaries changed because someone became administrator, that can do whatever they want with it. A non-Windows machine, they can definitely do whatever they want with it. Right? So the promise of non-exporting the private key is really up to the requester to agree to obey the rules. KPMT attestation says, that whole system that Craig just talked about, that whole virtual smart card thing, that's all going to fail if we can export the private key. So we need a system that guarantees that you will never export the private key, right? When you put it into TPM, we're effectively doing that, so we need a new certificate template and a new logic behind it that says our endorsement key is definitely stored within the TPM. These are the steps that you fire up. You go to your certificate templates. There it is there. TPM attestation request from a user. Schema version 4, so this is a version 4 certificate. How are we going to do this? So do you have to have key attestation? Does the certificate must go into the TPM? How are we going to enforce the fact that this user is really who they say they are? They can either type their credentials, not very good, because if they type their credentials to get two-factor authentication, haven't they just, you know, what's to stop a bad guy from doing that if they know their password? Or they could come along with a certificate, another smart card. Or they could come along with an endorsement key, so another key that's been stored inside TPM. And do we have to, when we issue that certificate, do we have to say it's gone through all of this stuff here? That's the bottom box there, include the issuance policies. Whew. Windows to go, all of a sudden. So Windows to go is the idea that you can take Windows, stick it on a USB key, plug that into any machine in the world, turn it on, and boot from it, and you'll be running your corporate image with all of your corporate applications, an offline copy of your documents, your work folders, your SkyDrive connection, your direct access group policies, your certificates, everything on one USB key, all ready to go, all BitLocker encrypted, so if it falls out your pocket, doesn't matter. If you're going to boot from a USB key and use it to work on, it's got to perform fast. That's what this says. It's got to perform fast, and it's got to last a little bit longer than 6 weeks. All right? We can't go and say it must be flash-based. It must be SSD-based. We can't go and say that because people could come up with clever stuff to work around it, right? But what we are saying is that it can't be that. It's got to be one of these guys here. In fact, they are the only seven that we have certified to this date to run Windows to Go because we know that they're going to be fast enough and reliable enough to do it. And the one that's interesting is the one in the corner there because that's a spinning hard disk. It's 500 gigs, but it's also got a flash layer at the top there, so it can put the operating system on the hot bit of the files onto that part and have that run really, really quickly, so it'll boot fast, and then go to the spinning part to go and get the rest of your data for your My Documents and things, so you can get 500 gigs out of it. The other ones are sort of 64 gigs, maybe 128. You go to the, Windows... hardware compatibility list to find out who's currently certified. So what's different about Windows to Go? So we had Windows to Go in 8.0, and we've made some 8.1 changes. Here they are now, that the store is now enabled. Before, you couldn't log on with your live ID and open up the store and download any applications. It was just for your corporate image and nothing else. So now we've opened that up. You could load your LOB, line of business applications, these guys, you could build your own and load them onto there. That still works. You can now boot UEFI and BIOS from the same key. So I can go to every Windows 8 device that you buy now has a logo on it that says Windows 8 certified. To get that, it must boot UEFI. Them's the rules, right? BIOS is now dead. We had it for 40-something years, and now we've finally said goodbye to it. But we haven't, because I just said that this should be able to work on any machine in the world. So you should be able to take your Windows to Go key, stick it into a MacBook, turn it off and on again, and it should be able to boot off that. The first boot that it does will go and do a big hardware detection, find all the wireless adapters and all that stuff, and it will shut down. And then it will boot up again. And then from then on, it's going really fast. So it depends on what drivers you've injected into there as to what functionality you're going to get. All right, but that's the expectation. And if you've got it up and running and it's working fantastic, your whole corporate image is in there, and you go and unplug it, you get a little sad face that comes up on your screen. It will sit there for 60 seconds saying, plug the damn thing back in. And if you don't, it blue screens. But you've got a nice opportunity to put it back in again, and it will continue on just as it did before. So what we did is we took both UEFI and BIOS and put them onto the same disk. Really, really, really hard to do, because your whole disk has to be formatted as either GPT, GUI Partition Table, or an MBR. Can't have both, but we've managed to figure out a way to do both. Users can go and do this. So I've got my Windows 8.1 machine at home, and I want to go and boot from my corporate image. I start typing, look for Windows to Go startup, get this little wee option here, and it says, would you like to go and boot Windows to Go now? Do you want to make this change permanent or not? If not, then you might need to go into the firmware of your machine to say, can you now boot from the USB, don't boot from SATA, don't boot from network. Users can also go and make their own Windows to Go boot disk. So there's a little Windows to Go thing within the control panel. This is the first screen that you see. It goes and detects your USB disks. And it's coming up with a little warning there. Just a warning saying, yeah, USB 3, eh? Come on, that would be a little bit better. It will do performance checks against it as well and say whether it's running fast enough or not. But we won't block it. It'll just be really, really bad if you use USB 2 and non-flash storage. And then we go and choose an offline image of Windows. Not the one that you're currently running this machine on, but another offline image, so a WIM file that you've gone and put all your stuff into. You've installed Office and blah, blah, you've captured a nice, fantastic image. And last one is to go and BitLocker that whole disk. So BitLocker will also support the ability to type a password on boot. Before, it was just a PIN number or a recovery key. And because the whole disk is now encrypted, you can lose it whenever you want. But that whole thing of building WIM images and blah, blah, it's not very self-deployment. We can do self-deployment now with SCCM. So users just go to the application catalog, looks a bit like this one here, choose to go and install a Windows to Go disk and hit install, and it will go and pull down the WIM image and then find the disk for you and then install the WIM image onto it. So you can build all of this stuff and just give it out to users. They just go to a web page. Right, that contoso.com is not really contoso.com. You can imagine where I took that screenshot from. That's how easy it is for me to go and install Windows to Go, and you as well. You just go and publish something in SCCM. This is the way we want you to be thinking. Sideloading. What have we got? 22. So we've got 8 minutes. That should be fine. Sideloading is the ability to take your line of business applications and then jam them into your piece of equipment. Auto-updating of modern apps means that we update modern apps automatically. And it's a little yes, no. Ah, it's a fantastic demo to go and give everyone. UEV is the thing that kind of links everything up together when you're talking about roaming profiles, but not just roaming. We don't want to roam everything within a roaming profile, just some bits are really important. So we took this idea of roaming profiles and we made something completely different. And we had to go and revision it for version 2 so that we can include some Windows 8.1 features. And then the whole sideloading management of applications we'll get to at the end there too. So, Windows embedded. This is another thing that IT pros should be looking into. We've had embedded for a long time, and not many people have been using it. It does all of these things here. It can be your thin clients. It can be the signs, the big Fiskatol sign out in front that had the LEDs on it. Windows embedded, right? That's what it is. It's just a copy of Windows that's been extremely hacked down, and then we go and put on a lockdown manager onto it to say no writes to C. There's my C drive. Pending restart, it will now be protected, which means any writes to C will just be dropped on reboot. I can go and turn off key combinations, right, so that the Windows key doesn't work, or Control-Alt-Delete doesn't work, or Control-F4 doesn't work. Right, really important stuff if you're going to make an automated teller machine that stands on the street front. Yes, auto-updating of Windows Store apps. They automatically update. Hurrah. Yeah, exactly. Why didn't we have that before? Kind of makes sense when you think about it. I now no longer go to the Windows Store because they automatically update. Before, I would get this little pop-up saying, you've got 8 apps to go and upgrade. I'd go into the store, upgrade, and go, oh, there's some other stuff here that I haven't seen for a while because I haven't been in my store for a while. I might try this app, might try that app. Now I don't go there, and I'm not paying for them anymore. So that was a big, should we really do that kind of decision, I think. And you can control that through group policy, whether it's enabled or not. UEV, we add the ability to roam settings from within an individual Windows Store app. All right, so I've gone and set this Windows Store app to focus on the Microsoft share price because I happen to own some shares in it. I can roam that, the fact that I'm watching Microsoft in this one application, to any other of my machines that I go to, but potentially nothing else. Maybe just my office settings and nothing else. Right? I can choose exactly the settings, whether it's registry keys or files, that I want to track with me, not my whole 14 gigabyte profile with my PSTs in it and all these sorts of things, just the things that I want. Right? Now we went and added, store apps can now do this. The problem with UEV was that it only ever synchronized when you logged on and logged off. Nah. And it would do it for lock on a terminal server as well. Now we do it background, all the time. And you also had to have offline files, unless you were a terminal server. You had to have offline files enabled on your machine because we store your stuff on a file server. How are you going to get access to the file server if you're working in an airport? So you have to have an offline copy of it, make changes there, and they synchronize up. That's all gone now. Work folders. And we gave the users a GUI so they can turn stuff on and off. Please don't synchronize my desktop settings for me. Like I have gone and set my kid to be the background image. Maybe that works well for this one machine, but not for another machine where I'm going to be telling my boss that I don't have problems with home-life balance because I'm spending all my time with my kids. So I can go and customize stuff that I couldn't do before. Shift F5. There we go. And we're also going to give them a list of things that the admin has defined by policy that they can't switch off. Right, just so they know what else is also being synchronized. Side loading is the ability to go and take your line of business apps, bundle them into Windows. If you have a Windows 8 Enterprise Edition and you are domain joined, you can do this automatically. If you aren't domain joined, you need a separate product key to be able to support side loading. And if you're Windows Pro, you need it regardless whether you're domain joined or not, but you can also do it on Windows RT as well. So I can side load applications that my IT department has built and put them onto my RT device. And there's a little process. You can either install the application, which installs as the user, right? All of my applications, my store applications, install as me, not into program files, but into my profile. Or I can provision them, which would be like the SCCM push model of application installation, which requires admin rights and blah, blah, blah. So how do we do it? We've got the public application from the public store, push, push, push. And then line of business applications can push out or through a self-service portal. That would be the application catalog that we saw before, or Windows Intune, or whatever else it is. Windows Intune talks back to SCCM, grabs your packages, pushes them on your RT devices. There's that catalog again. We've also got something called the company portal. It's a public app. You go to the Windows Store, you can go and get it. It's unconfigured. So you have to join Intune, which will say, oh, you're from Contoso, so these are your policies. You must have these help desk numbers, and you should have this list of applications, and this is how we'll sort it. All of that stuff will be controlled within the app, but defined from Intune. So it's all customized to you. And that is the mobile device management bit, right? Intune really is just... mobile device management is a standard. It's not something that we've invented, but Intune is our offering of a way of controlling mobile devices, whether they are RT or iPhones or whatever else they are, Android devices. So long as they support mobile device management, we can manage them from Intune. So here's an example of an iPad, I think it is. Yes, Nicholas's iPad enrolling to become a managed device. And it's all, this one is GUI driven, like it's within the iOS stuff. You don't have to go to a web page. If you wanted to get your certificate, you had to go to the web page, but this one will, because it's mobile device management, there we are there. My profile contains mobile device management. I can now control it through SCCM, effectively, SCCM via Intune, and I've enrolled for a certificate as well. That SCEP is the simple device request service for certificate requests like routers and printers and things. We consider an iOS device to be a simple device. Shouldn't we all? Yeah, whole bunch of stuff in terminal services. You can now have multiple types of authentication. So before you could either do password or certificate, now you can go and plug in any type of other factor of authentication, whether it is an RSA key or a SMS, whatever else system you're using. You can plug in any kind of system into the terminal server gateway. 2008 R2, you could shadow a session. 2012, you couldn't. 2012 R2, you can. So it's back. Hurrah. The reason that we took it out is because it was really, really, really hard to do things like that, shadowing this session, especially if you've got multi-monitors, especially if one of those monitors tilts. How do I deal with that? If I go and add another monitor, things got really, really complicated. So we just took it out and said, we've got to make deadline. Boom. We're not going to include these products. We'll get it in the next version. Here we are, next version. So you can go and hot add monitors into your shadowing session. It will just work. MSTSC is aware that it's shadowing somebody else's session. We have a whole world of stuff about making VDI amazing. So there's some really good VDI sessions. I'll put some links at the end of this that you can get to. Deduplication of data and scale-out file server and this one here, storage tiering, are all about making VDI amazing, right, on the storage stack. So I did a session about SANs on Tuesday. We talked a lot about the stuff from there. So go and have a look at that session if you weren't there already. Dynamically add and remove monitors. This one here is the coolest one. Quick reconnect. If I, with a terminal server session, connect to you and then something happens, you get this little time error and it says, I'm trying to reconnect to Bob in 20 different reconnection attempts. And each of those will be about 20 seconds. 20 times 20, 400 seconds of standing there waiting for this thing to time out. Now we will give each of those 2 seconds. So it finishes quicker. But in that time, it's actually trying to do a reconnection. It's saying, TCP, stop being a silly bugger and extending your windows. We're just going to send 3389 packets really, really fast. And we improve performance for DirectX and streaming applications. Whew. So all of this will be up on here. This was more like a taster rather than an in-depth. Okay, so this is to get you interested in some stuff. So you go to the webpage afterwards, and all of these slides will be available. Not all of them, like the making fun of Apple things will probably not be there. But you know, enough will be there to get the gist of what's going on so that you can go and find some keywords there, like mobile device management and Intune, and go and look it up afterwards. These are the sessions that you can go and look at that have something that goes a little bit deeper, especially the two that I want to poke out here are the DA305, the second one down. Klaus Jespersen is amazing at setting stuff up, and he's been doing a lot of work on this with our customers. And then, where are we? Where is Matthew's session? It's at the top one, WC305 as well. So that's coming at 4 o'clock, the last session, the 2:45-ish session, I think. That was definitely one that you want to go and have a look at. So, brings us to the end. Your evaluations, you send a text message, if you're not aware of this one already, to that session code for me. You do a number for what you thought of Craig, and for all the other bits, you put in a number as well, okay? So it will end up looking like this, WC305, and then three numbers, whatever you choose to. I love you very much. Care for you in a deep, special way. And yeah, go off and enjoy your lunch. There's a list on this set of slides of an appendix, I think, of some commands and things that I didn't include within the presentation, so that if you ever get stuck with things, you can go and have a look at that. Oh, the bit that's next. Did you want to do that? Or no? Was that a resounding no? Okay. Did you guys see this one? This is probably not for the recording, if we can... just to be a bit cheeky. Did you guys, there was this little web thingy that went around saying, we were doing a crowdfunding project here, we'd like people to go and contribute, and I think they were looking for like $15 million to go and build this thing they thought was really, really cool. And I looked at this video and I thought, holy cow, that relates to us like in a major way, right? So I just play the little video. I've gone and squeezed it a little bit because it was their stuff, not our stuff, and I'll see what you guys think of it too. So, what's the difference between these two things here? ARM-based processors, 1.7 gigahertz, 4-core, 2-core, 2 gigs of RAM, 2 gigs of RAM, SSD-based storage, I got 32 gigs on here and it's expandable. I got 64 gigs on this one, or 32 gigs on here, but the same. Wireless, USB, USB. Windows Store connectivity, Live ID authenticates me. Mobile device policies push down and wipe the thing. Speakers, microphone, front-facing camera, rear-facing camera, can do Skype on them, can do link calls on them. The only difference really between these two is that this one needs a bigger battery to keep this bigger screen alive. Wouldn't it be cool if I can get all of those line of business applications installed on here to also install on here and then do what she's doing, and that is now my PC. All we'd really need to do that is go and buy some massive phone manufacturing company. You know? This is why we're investing in ARM, isn't it? Surely, it's not just to go and be better than iPad. Isn't it to do something really, really, really different? This thing here that you're seeing here, that's a real thing. It's a phone that dual boots Android and Ubuntu, right? So you have to go and shut down your phone to do what she's doing to have it dual boot. But why? I mean, if it's almost the same application, can't it just scale the size to fit the monitor that you happen to be plugged into? I think that's pretty cool when I saw that. That's the end of it. Go off and have your lunch. Thank you very much for coming and sitting around and listening to me talk for as long as you did. I hope you got something out of it that will make you do something new in your work. Cool. Thanks, guys.